Hello and welcome to episode 50 from the Self-Publishing Formula podcast.
Two writers, one just starting out, the other a bestseller. Join James Blatch and Mark Dawson and their amazing guests as they discuss how you can make a living telling stories. There's never been a better time to be a writer.
We made it, half a century.
I know.
50, who would, I mean, who? 50 sounds ancient, doesn't it? Who would be 50?
I don't know. Anyone in the room for 50? Well, hang on, one. No, we'll gloss over that.
We'll ignore the fact that someone might be 50 soon. But here we are, episode 50 for the podcast. And it started as something we thought, because we think and breathe and live modern indie publishing and all the ideas that come up, and we listen to other podcasts, but we thought there was something we could do here, which is each week to talk about an episode, talk about something that would be of use to people. And here we are, 50 episodes later, we have thousands of listeners. The YouTube channel is growing, if you're watching us on YouTube. And yeah, we love doing it, don't we?
We do, and we've got some fun things that will be coming down the line as well. We're going to be rebranding a little bit. There'll be some, the YouTube channel will get a bit of a lick of paint. But we'll still obviously concentrate on, you know, it's just providing the content, and you can choose how to consume it. If you like seeing James and I, you can watch us on video. Or if you just rather have us go directly to your ears whilst you're running or doing the dishes or whatever, obviously then the podcast is where you need to be subscribing. But yeah, we're pleased to get to 50. Well done.
Yeah, and we'd also be delighted if you left us a review on iTunes. That's very helpful for us if you'd like to do that. And we do respond to every comment. If you comment on our YouTube video, I always dive in there, even if it's mildly critical, which it isn't very often, but occasionally. Here we are. We're digital people in the digital space, ones and zeros everywhere. And I'm so pleased about today's interview and today's guest, because it's somebody from the heart of traditional publishing who has no move to indie on his agenda or his horizon anywhere. He's a traditional guy. In fact, he's starting a new imprint, and that's why we spoke to him. But what this interview shows is how much crossover there is between traditional and indie. We are all about books. First and foremost, we're about books, about loving books, about writing them, about coming up with good ideas, about making your book something that people are going to want to read. And it doesn't matter whether you're doing this by yourself in your bedroom or you're a Hodder or Penguin, you have to get all those things right. It's just a bit more pressure on this guy because he's looking after other people's money and a big company, so he's got to make these decisions correctly. But it's a fascinating interview. It's an absolutely lovely guy. And I think you know Alex, did you? How did you come across Alex?
Yeah, I was on a panel in London last year with, I can't remember what the topic was, but Alex was there. There was an agent there again. So they were obviously from the traditional side of the spectrum. And I was the young Turk, pushing the indie argument. But yeah, Alex is great, and that's the way I look at it is like this. It isn't so much books, it's stories. We're in the story business, the storytelling business. And whether it's whether you distribute those stories by way of a file, digital download, or with paper, doesn't really matter. That's just the delivery mechanism. The story is the main thing, and we're just looking at different ways to get the story into the hands of readers.
Yeah.
Alex has no axe to grind, and neither do we. I mean, I think that's important to lay out there as well. That, you know, I am traditionally published in different countries. So I've got traditional deals in Germany, in Italy, in the Czech Republic. I have been traditionally published in the UK before. I've got nothing against traditional publishing. The difference these days is that I'm able to reach out to readers directly without needing to take recourse to that kind of way of doing things. But in principle, if someone came and offered me an amount of money for the Milton books and I felt it was a good opportunity, I'd be up for it. But the bottom line is, and this is the kind of the, I was going to say curse and a blessing, it's probably actually neither of those, it's just a fact, is I have a lot of data on how much my books, how they sell, what I can expect from them, and I can extrapolate what those books therefore are worth. So it enables me to make qualified decisions on how I choose to publish them. At the moment, it looks to me that self-publishing is really the only way I'm interested in going. But, you know, all options are on the table. I'm always open to ideas.
And in terms of what's going to be of use to me as a budding author listening to this interview, and the questions I asked, I really geared it around really tapping into Alex's masterful view of books and what makes a book sell, what he's looking for in a book that he knows is going to, he, in his view, has the best chance of working. And that's valuable for us then, because if you think the way that he thinks, a very critical eye, and you know, I think you hear Alex talk about this very openly, it's an art, not a science. But that's only going to help us listen to the way that he views the way that books come to him and what he's looking for. It's only going to help me craft my book, you craft your book. So his name is Alex Clark. As I say, he's starting a new imprint. I'll let him introduce himself in a moment, and then we'll come back and have a chat afterwards.
I am setting up a new imprint here at Headline, and the imprint is called Wildfire. And I had been at Penguin for 15 years, where I was publishing director. And at the beginning of the year, I was asked by the MD of Headline if I'd come here and set up a new imprint. And broadly speaking, the imprint is looking at quality commercial fiction and nonfiction. And in terms of the balance of the list, hopefully long term, it will be about 50-50 fiction and nonfiction. But in terms of commercial fiction, particularly, we're looking for crime thrillers, high concepts thrillers, a bit of historical, and some of the more sort of, I guess, commercial end of reading group fiction. And the sort of bottom line for the kind of ethos of the imprint is, you know, we've called it Wildfire because that's the kind of books we want to publish. We want to publish books that people love talking about, basically, that kind of you pick up, you read, and you want to tell your friends about straight away. And, you know, we, in terms of setting that tone, our kind of touch line has been basically books with a little bit of soul, books that you do feel happy talking about with your friends and family.
So commercial fiction, and from your description, you're talking about the books that people want to sit and read on the tube, and as you say, then have a discussion about afterwards. I'm curious about the choice between combining fiction and non-fiction, because actually there is, you talk very much about the commercial fiction, and then how does the non-fiction fit into that? How can it be a stablemate?
I mean, I've been very fortunate as a publisher that I've always published a mixture of fiction and nonfiction. I think from a personal point of view, it keeps my brain ticking over quite nicely. But in terms of sort of dynamic of the nonfiction, traditionally I've published a lot of celebrity autobiography, a bit of historical nonfiction, narrative nonfiction, and some sort of big ideas, whether it's science or whether it's sort of issue-led ideas type nonfiction, and that's very much the tone we're looking for Wildfire is finding books again that are talking points. And the way I publish has always been to find someone a bit different, a bit interesting, or well known to talk about such subjects. So it might be gender equality, it might be environmental issues, or it might be a kind of particular historical figure or period, and finding someone who can really reach out to as large an audience as possible in as interesting way as possible. That's how we're sort of defining our hunt for nonfiction.
Okay. And I read a fair mix of nonfiction and fiction. I don't think it's that unusual. And I completely see the argument that it keeps you on your toes and keeps you keeps you interested, because I think there's a lot to be said for that, actually, and in sort of change, because there's a cultural difference between the two and having to switch from one to the other. But I mean, I suppose we'll talk about what's going to be, I suppose, more directly relevant to people like me and people who want to write and want to be published at some point in a moment. But I'm still interested in the thought process that goes into setting up a new imprint. And I guess there's economies of scale within an organization that would they go across fiction and nonfiction, or were you going to have sort of an invisible line in the middle of the company?
In terms of how you structure a publishing list, I think one always has to think about, how is your publishing going to be spread out throughout the year in terms of A, the investment you're putting in, whether it's advances or production or the marketing and publicity of a book. But having, whether it's repeat series fiction every month, so that you're creating an engine in terms of your revenue and also your creative output. And that allows you to think of the kind of more seasonal nonfiction, say, you'd look to publish a celebrity-based book in the autumn for the Christmas market. You might look to publish a more ideas-based nonfiction book in a sort of spring market. And when I think about structuring a list, it's building a sort of pyramid of repeat authors, brand fiction that you know is going to hit the market in a certain way, and then you'll have maybe one or two books that are kind of the big make word of mouth books that you're hoping will become the next Girl on the Train, the next Gone Girl, whatever it might be. And you can only realistically, as a sort of a contained publishing company, you're only going to get one or two shots at that kind of book per year. So you've got to balance your structure throughout the year so that you're able to give space to that kind of big make book. So it's lining up all the kind of the bits of revenue in as creative and as fruitful way for the individual books and how they might best land in the market, really.
Okay. Well, let's talk about how you, or what you look for. And you talk about the talked about book and the recommended book. And I can remember from my commute into London, I read The Lovely Bones and The Da Vinci Code and a few others just because I saw everybody else reading them. And, you know, it started exactly that, isn't it? There's one book that comes up every now and again, Girl on Train at the moment. And you want to find them and we want to write them. So what are the top tips? What are you looking for? What should we be doing?
It's very interesting at the moment. I think, you know, you referenced Girl on the Train and, you know, things like the Da Vinci Code. And traditionally there's usually every year, every season, there's one book that goes crazy. Possibly, you know, in a year cycle, you get one, two, very rarely three books that hit that level where they sell 500,000, 1 million copies. And obviously as a publisher, that's the Holy Grail. It's very hard to predict that. And what's been interesting about the kind of post, I guess, Before I Go to Sleep was the first of the sort of new generation of psychological thrillers, as we call them in the publishing industry. You had Before I Go to Sleep, you had Gone Girl, now you've got Girl on the Train. And what's interesting is that they are all performing to a similarly high level, whereas you look at something like The Da Vinci Code, that was its own unique phenomena. And the same with 50 Shades of Grey. And then everything that kind of fell into the copycat, to use a sort of diminutive term, which I don't think is necessarily fair, but everything that followed tends to have a sort of half-life, and eventually that trend sort of runs out of steam. And what's been very interesting about the psychological thriller kind of trope within publishing, it hasn't seemed to have run out of steam. Actually, these pillars that have come along, the Gone Girl, The Girl on the Train, each has been as high as the last, and each has had a sort of wave of kind of follow-up publishing afterwards. So at the moment, you know, I've just come out of the back of the sort of Frankfurt frenzy, and a very significant percentage of the fiction we were receiving on submission from agents was in that psychological thriller area category. And I can't see it going away, certainly for the foreseeable 18 months of publishing, knowing what's been bought by publishers and including ourselves, psychological thriller is here to stay. So I think there's something in that in terms of picking what one is going to write about. I think you do have to write what's, you know, coming from within, but also I think it does help to have a bit of a sense of what's working in the market as well.
Yeah. And I guess if you look at the movies, the psychological thriller, going back to the 30s and the 40s or 50s and Hitchcock, and today has been a mainstay of what draws people into seeing a story play out. So there's some backing up there that it's got longevity. So you say it's difficult. Obviously it is difficult to spot that, and you are being, you are having a lot of these pushed at you at the moment by agents and authors. So yes. How do you do that? I mean, where's that magic, formula that you're looking for when you're reading?
I wish there was a straightforward magical formula. I think what is immediately impressive when you read something is you know, it's the sort of very cliched adage, start with a bang. And I think, you know, as a publisher, one doesn't necessarily have the luxury of reading 250 pages of every manuscript that gets submitted. Time simply doesn't permit it. So starting with that kind of explosive beginning is a good way of getting your attention. Doesn't mean every book has to start that way, but it does help. I think what we're definitely, you know, one has a visceral response to a certain kind of writing, whatever that writing might be, in whatever category that that writing might be, and the quality of, you know, prose skill is something that really jumps out immediately. You can tell immediately whether someone has got that magical gift with words, and I think being able to structure that within a kind of immediately graspable concept or hook or story, and being able to give me that one line pitch, that one paragraph pitch at the beginning, introducing the book to me, so I know what I'm expecting, and then you kind of get captured by that magical prose. That's what I'm looking for.
Yeah, that high concept you referred to earlier, and so I suppose we should be thinking about the tagline and the classically the elevator pitch. And if we've got that right and that works, and then it builds on that, then that's a good start from your point of view. And you're looking for. Like you, is you be careful with language to don't want to reduce things, but you're looking for fairly instantaneous gratification here. You've got to, it's got to basically do what it's setting out to do from a quite early on. As you say, I don't know, you don't read 250 pages, you probably, I don't know how far into the books you get, but it's got to be doing it pretty swiftly.
Pretty swiftly, yeah. And, you know, I think as editors, we get very used to sort of making our minds up pretty quickly. But, you know, that doesn't mean to say that every book has to start with that, you know, James Bond-esque scene. But you do get a sense very quickly of the ability of the prose. But as you say, the elevator pitch is so crucial. If you as a writer are unable to pitch the book in one line to me, how am I as an editor going to be able to pitch it to my colleagues and then them to the sales retailers, you know, that kind of immediacy of being able to say what your book is about.
Yeah. And ultimately we can imagine the reader browsing the bookstore or online, and they're the ultimate test of that, aren't they?
Yeah. And it, you know, people are very sort of time poor when it comes to making judgments. You know, the sort of typical anecdote is that you have 7 seconds of kind of passing time as a shopper walks through the aisles of Tesco in the book section. And, you know, think 7 seconds, I've got to, as a publisher, I've got to convey exactly what, as a reader, you're going to get in that book. And that's a title, that's a cover image, and it's a strap line. And, you know, if you're thinking about your own writing in those terms, I think it also helps you have an enormous clarity as to what you're trying to achieve. You can visualize, you know, your end audience, as it were, and what you're trying to do with them. I think that actually helps the writing process enormously as well.
Yeah. And how much do you know about the books when you start reading them? And do you is there space for the submission from the agent or the author? Is there a place for the paragraph, the high concept elevator pitch?
There is, yes. And you know, I will always, you know, when I'm looking at submission, I'll always sort of see how someone's positioning it. You know, it sort of gets my mind in the right place, and it also saves me time in terms of thinking, okay, I know I'm looking out for a crime thriller here. What kind of crime thriller is it? Is it a serial killer, or is it a procedural? And that sort of puts me in the right mindset. And I think you can capture someone with a brilliant title and a brilliant kind of strapline pitch, and you're setting their expectations perfectly, and I think that's very important. As a publisher, you go in with a certain mindset as you start reading, and you know, you're drawn into the tension, the intrigue, the build up, whatever it is, simply by that title, you know, that killer title. Or anything, Girl on a Train, Jesus, that's a good title.
Yeah. I've noticed quite a few A Girl on a Trains being published in the last couple of weeks.
Well, there's Girl on a Train, The Girl on a Train, The Girl on the Train, so you know, you know. But having said that, you know, the title is something we all struggle with as authors, publishers. It's so important, and I'd urge, you know, all aspiring writers out there to really focus on that title and test it, try it, because you can do so much work with a great title. And you know, in a way, it's your most immediate marketing tool if you're being sort of commercial about it. So it's hugely important and quite difficult to get right.
I was reading recently some of the stats on who buys and consumes books, and it was laying out bare the fact that it is women who are the voracious readers and the main audience we should be thinking about. Is that your experience?
It's very interesting. And, you know, I started off my editorial career publishing for a more male audience in fiction terms. So I was publishing a lot of, big epic historical series, Romans, Napoleonic era stuff. And that market has sort of changed a bit, particularly with the advent of ebook. And it's a bit harder to reach those people. It doesn't necessarily mean they've gone away. But I think for the most part, statistically, you are looking at women buying more books than men. And whether it's they're buying the books and then passing them on, or whether they're buying them for themselves is a moot point. But the Holy Grail is buying a book that both appeals to a male and a female audience. And that's, you'd be surprised that certain authors who you would think actually might, appeal to a certain gender actually appeal to a much more broad mix of demographic. And that's the Holy Grail. And on the male readership front, I think what's been very interesting, I guess, in the post I Am Pilgrim world is you've got books like Crisis, Nomad, recently Greg Hurwitz's Orphan X. There seems to be a resurgence of the more kind of adrenaline action-packed male thriller, and that market has been very hard in publishing terms for the last sort of 5-10 years. And actually this year it seems to have had a fairly significant renaissance, which I wish I could tell you why. All I can tell you is I'm keen to find some books in that area now.
Yeah. My book starts in a 1960s nuclear RAF bomber, so I'm not sure I'm pitching quite to the target female audience at the moment, but who knows? I'm in the edit stage now, so maybe I'll introduce a room. It sounds very cliched and horrible, doesn't it? I'll introduce romantic storylines if that's what women are interested in. But as you say, and I Am Pilgrim's a good example of that. There are some universal things we're all worried about or intrigued about. International terrorism probably is one of them at the moment, and those are themes that are probably going to work across both, aren't they?
Yeah, first of all, which bomber?
I'm a Vulcan.
Brilliant. I mean, you've sold me straight away.
High concept. I'm going to have to definitely put it in front of you, and it's
I think there are universal themes. And having said that, I think it's always interesting, how authors manage to come at it from different angles. And that's what's exciting as a publisher, is when you find someone who's taking a universal theme but just has a slight tilt shift in terms of perspective or handling. And that's what we're always keen to find.
Yeah. So, I was going to sort of move on to the mistakes that people make or authors make, but in a way, I suppose we just reverse engineer what you've said so far. So sort of rambling, unfocused beginning to their books, and it doesn't really give you a sense of what the book's about. It doesn't match the pitch and so on. So that's an obvious one, I guess, you must come across from time to time.
Yes. I think, being very clear with your pitch is crucial, and the lack of clarity is an immediate alarm bell. If a pitch letter or a pitch document doesn't have that clarity, it doesn't necessarily bode well for the novel as a whole. That's not obviously universally true, and please don't sort of think I'm speaking in universals here, but that is a definite no-no. What else? I think some people can take a long while to get to the sort of meat of their story, and it's a real discipline to think, okay, what is my reader journey here? What am I expecting people to do with the sort of process of engaging with the story? And certainly a tip I often give my authors is look at, when you're thinking about formulating your narrative arc and your structure, look at how screenplays do that process. And there is such a sort of discipline to creating, whether it's a 3 or 5 act structure within screenwriting. And there's some great books out there that give you really, really good tips for that structuring of your narrative arc, your kind of beats of tension and intrigue and sustaining your audience interest. A great example of that would be Into the Woods by John York, who was the director of BBC drama for a long time, and he gives a brilliant outline of how to be very disciplined with your structural planning. And I think it's always a real help for an author to think about keeping that rhythm of audience engagement, and that five-act structure or three-act structure, depending on how you do it, is a really easy way of disciplining yourself in that process.
Yeah, it was funny how much people talk in the industry about films and books and have them very closely aligned today. And I'm not sure why, whether that's changed from where it was 20 or 30 years ago, but my editor talks to me a lot about watch this film, see how the structure works, rather than read this book and that book. I mean, obviously it's a lot quicker to watch a film than read an entire novel, but it must be more to do with the fact that that films have really nailed how to tell a story.
I think there's an interesting sort of circle there, isn't it? Because so many films are coming from books still, and you know, in Frankfurt, I'm you know, many of my meetings are with film scouts who are looking for books to turn to film, and film and TV are so dependent on the creativity that comes out of writing. But I think you're right, actually, when you're spending, whether it's $5 million or $100 million on a film production, boy, do you get it right if you can. Yeah. You know, and there's such discipline over you know, the exposition of story, and they don't always get it right, but there's a real discipline to it. And I think it just helps in terms of the experience filmmakers and TV makers, in the same way that writers have of understanding their audience's reaction, is something that everyone can learn from. So
yeah, I mean, they obviously have other tools in their armory in terms of creating this impression on the audience, but the story, I actually remember reading I Am Pilgrim thinking this has been written for the screen, and it was no surprise to me after I'd finished it that I read up on the guy who wrote it. It was in fact a screenwriter more than a novelist, and that that book read like a film to me.
Yeah, and you know, it's really interesting. I actually had commissioned a novel when I was still at Penguin by a screenwriter called Alain Mastai, and I had a drink with him the other day, and it was really interesting hearing his sort of experiences of coming from having been a screenwriter and what he was actually able to do more in terms of the internal voice, in terms of the kind of emotional journey writing for you know, a novelized work. You know, he was in many ways that he felt set free by that process.
Interesting.
You know, I think there's sort of two sides to the coin, so I don't think any one discipline can claim to be the more rich art. I think that's the joy of it.
Yeah. So when you've read your book, obviously there's a few decisions you can make in the first instance, and in the majority of cases this is not going to be for us. Some are going to be your look at them and think this is a fully formed product, but I'm imagining that most books you see them as of interest to you at that early stage, and then how much work goes on between you and the author? I know you're going to say this varies a lot, but typically
it varies a lot, James. That is the most straightforward answer, and I think every case is different, and I think every, you know, I try, and at the end of the day, the important part of the process is that an author feels, you know, that they are getting the best out of their writing, and you know, it's my job to help an author achieve the best they can possibly do. I'm not the creative part of the equation, the author is, but my role is to make sure that I'm able to just tease out whatever strengths and sort of iron out whatever wrinkles that we can, and that will vary absolutely from person to person. And you know, I guess that's one of the great joys in working as a publisher, is that you are on a different journey every time. You know, as I say, the crucial thing from my point of view is it's the author's, you know, it's their hard work here, and it's my job to make sure that they are able to publish the best possible book.
Yeah, we interviewed Claire McIntosh earlier this year, and I was a little surprised that after she did the deal with the publisher, there was 2 years of rewriting and working with her book, which she seemed, you know, delighted with the process, and a huge learning process for her. But I'm wondering what they saw at the beginning that made them know that this was going to be worth the investment, considering how much it changed in those 2 years.
again, it's so much horses for courses. And I think, you know, so often you will be captured by a certain element of a story or a certain character, or, you know, there are so many different things that capture you. And there are so many, you know, authors like to work in very different ways. And you know, sometimes these things can take a lot of time, and other times you need to do relatively little work with a story. And I think, you know, our job is to make sure that that process is as kind of creatively rewarding as possible. But, you know, as to what we see in the first place, that's the sort of alchemy.
It's got to be a hunch quite a lot of the time, isn't it? It won't necessarily be, as we alluded to, the fully formed article, but there's got to be something there for you. And I guess that's what you paid for, Alex.
I hope so. it is a hunch, but it's more often than not, it's a very calculated hunch. And I think, you know, our job as publishers is to ensure that we are kind of responding to the constantly shifting sands of the kind of readership market, and trends do change all the time. And also, you know, as a publisher, my role is to make sure that our breadth of publishing is sufficiently broad to cater for a number of different genres or categories or interest areas. And that's, from a creative point of view, that's very rewarding. But also from a financial point of view, you're spread betting effectively. You're not putting all your eggs in one basket from a kind of category or a commercial point of view.
And how do people get to you, Alex? Obviously, agents are an important part of your life, but you must get a lot of unsolicited manuscripts as well.
We do get a lot of unsolicited manuscripts. I mean, the bottom line is 99% of what we do is through agents, simply because of the volume involved. You know, the first sort of filter process is through a literary agent. Having said that, you know, we're always looking at, you know, whether it's self-publishing platforms, whether it's you know, places like Wattpad or you know, there are any number of different areas where people are using words in very creative ways. And, you know, particularly in the nonfiction arena, for example, my first nonfiction title for the list next year is based on a Facebook blog. And we're constantly on the lookout. You know, my job is to try and keep eyes on as much of sort of cultural output as possible. So how to reach us, the straightforward answer is through a literary agent. But I think there are so many ways in which, whether it's through a Faber Academy writing course, whether it's through a brilliant piece of self-publishing, or whether it's through a Facebook blog or some other kind of blog platform, there are so many different ways in which one can garner attention for your creative work. And I think that's what's brilliant about publishing at the moment, is that we're in this kind of perfect world of so many different areas of kind of creative energy going on out there. It's brilliant. I mean, we're inundated with very talented people.
And do you find yourself trawling around? I mean, this Facebook blog, for instance, is this something that you spotted and you made the approach, or was somebody savvy enough to work out there was potentially a longer form project here and approach you with it?
I had spotted it, but it had come to us through a literary agent. You know, literary agents are very canny at keeping their eyes open for these things. So the agent had approached the blogger and you know, then signed up a deal and pitched the book, pitched a proposal. So agents are brilliant at that, and you know, thank God they are. It makes our publishing jobs much easier. But having said that, you know, I'm constantly approaching people, whether it's in you know, for a non-fiction project because of their particular expertise, or whether it's because I've seen a piece of creative writing in a, you know, on whatever platform. I do approach people, and that's a great and very rewarding part of the job is getting out there and sort of hustling to find interesting projects.
Now, Alex, you mentioned self-publishing. Obviously, probably most of our listeners are like me, and that's probably the route that we're looking at in the immediate future. Although most successful self-publishers at some point become hybrid, and in whether it's the foreign books or just a different series or so on, we'll start to move into trad as well. But from your point of view, what's What's the impact on your industry from what is frankly an explosion at the moment of self-publishing?
You know, I think it's a very interesting development for publishing as a whole. And, you know, several of the authors I've taken on over the last number of years have come from that background. You know, someone like James Oswald, for example, a Scottish crime writer, had self-published his first two books, crime series, and extremely successfully, and had then got a literary agent, and we actually republished those two books before publishing the third in the series. And I think there's an interesting kind of dynamic now as to, you know, as a self-published writer, not only are you doing the sort of hard graft on the writing, you're also marketing yourself. You're thinking about your positioning. You're thinking about how to get people to notice your books. And that's a very interesting new dynamic in the publisher-author relationship, and what we can learn from self-published authors and how they've managed to get themselves noticed, and what we can, you know, add to that process in terms of traditional publishing and distribution and the sort of marketing and publicity we're able to bring to bear. You know, I think there's an increasingly fruitful circle developing here, and I'm always, you know, keeping my eyes very much open as to what's going on, which authors are breaking through in that arena.
Yeah, that's good to hear, because that's how it should be, I think, as well. And the bottom line, Alex, I mean, there's obviously for self-published authors who are doing well, and Mark's a good example of that, they can show you a spreadsheet, which is considerably helped by the 65% that they get of the income from their books, and against traditional deals, which don't normally work like that, certainly haven't in the past. Is it affecting the way that you're doing deals now? Are you having to adjust your expectations?
I mean, the traditional publishing contract is, you know, there's lots of tweaks that happen over time to publishing contracts. We all have, you know, agreed boilerplates with various agencies, and these evolve over time. But, you know, because of the nature of print distribution, and, you know, that's still a very significant proportion of the publishing business.
And that's expensive, right?
It is expensive, and you know, it's you know, in terms of the upfront risk a publisher takes to print and distribute a book, that, you know, there's a significant financial expense there. So I think those contracts that we have with authors are pretty much the same as they were, say, 5 years ago. And there are little evolutions, and there will continue to be little evolutions, but the business model isn't radically changing because of the nature of the print, you know, digital balance is still as it is at the moment. And I think as long as that's how the marketplace is keen to experience their books, you know, just as many people want to read the paper object as people who want to read it on Kindle. So, you know, as long as there are those people, I think that the business model will stay fairly similar.
And in 10 years, you don't think there's going to be a significant change?
Oh, I think if I knew that, James.
Don't know what's happening next month, but, you know.
Yeah, never make predictions. If you're looking statistically at the moment, it seems that there is a bit of a flattening out of the growth of ebook reading as opposed to the sort of decline of print. They seem to be in something of a stable period at the moment. So it seems that people are still split, however, which way, in terms of reading on Kindle or reading in paper.
Well, I've just ordered a vinyl turntable. So if that's anything to go by, if that's a trend, vinyl's made a resurgence, isn't it? So
it has. And, you know, what I find fascinating about publishing is, you know, you look at whether it's, you know, I published this ridiculous Atlas last year, which was an absolutely beautiful piece of paper production. And, you know, it did very well as a £25 Atlas. It was, you know, a crazy piece of publishing. I should probably never have gone there, but it worked really well because people love the kind of the artifact, that it's almost a sort of a fetishized object, isn't it? A book, you know, you love the feel and the smell of the paper, and you love the experience of engaging with that. So
Yeah, and however good the ebook platform can become, and I suppose ultimately you can view using some of the Apple software, etc., on a laptop. There are some books that are never going to be replaced from the paper versions.
No, you know, I think what's brilliant about the sort of evolution of digital is that, you know, it's so much easier to walk around and you know, listen to your music, read your book when you're commuting into London or whatever. You know, there are so many different options, but at the same time, there's, you know, we're getting ever more beautiful productions of paper books, which is great. So being able to do both is like having the vinyl edition and being able to listen to it on your iPhone. So.
Yeah, exactly, which is probably where we're getting to. That's great, Alex. Thank you. I mean, the beginning part, I think, or the middle section that when we talked about is in, we always try and think, you know, what's going to be of value and of use to people listening to the podcast, because time is precious. And if people take away one lesson, I guess it's what we were talking about of being able to describe your book in a sentence or two, and then your book matching that description.
I think so. You know, I think as a sort of piece of marketing yourself, which is a horrible phrase, sorry.
That's okay.
But also in terms of actually, it's really helpful in terms of your creative clarity. And I think it informs the process of writing as well. If you're able to stick to that clarity, and this doesn't apply to every kind of book, you know, there are certain kind of books that sort of defy that. But as a sort of, you know, in terms of commercial category fiction, that is very much a useful tool to have in your armory.
Yeah. I mean, not all books do work like that, but then authors... I often read the exceptions. I love Ian McEwan's, my favourite authors, but I have no idea how his books work. I love reading them, but I couldn't tear apart his books or work out why they're successful. But I often think that's just enjoy that. Read Ian McEwan, but don't think about that when you're writing.
Yeah. You know, as I say, there are always going to be books that do defy definition. But I think certainly in the area I work in, which is, you know, commercial fiction, so much of it is about positioning, about categorizing, about being very, very clear to the consumer. If you love that kind of book, you're going to love this kind of book. And just having that crisp vision and being able to communicate that instantly is a great asset for your writing.
Give them what they want.
Give them what they want. And yeah, exactly.
Excellent. Alex, thank you so much indeed for joining us.
Not at all, James. Thanks so much for having me.
Alex Clark, what an absolutely lovely guy. I loved doing that interview. And obviously, we do talk to people most of the time who are immersed in the digital kind of revolution of indie publishing. And there is a bit of us and them in some areas of the industry. So going into that interview, I wasn't sure how it was going to fit into our flow, but it fitted in absolutely perfectly because, of course, as it turns out, we're all trying to sell books.
Yeah, exactly. And he's, yeah, I think I'll be right in saying he's asked you to send
unbelievable
your book to him. So that's
piqued his interest.
Yeah, absolutely.
I don't need an agent. I go straight to
you. Don't need me. we'll call it a day. No more. We'll stop at 50.
I'm off. I loved it. I loved talking to Alex. A really nice guy. I want to definitely keep in touch with him. I want to talk to him at least once a year because he's somebody also who understands how books are changing. And this whole thing about the book on, you know, that everyone's reading on the tube, The Girl on the Train, or Da Vinci Code a few years ago, whatever it is, that trend is something, of course, he's keenly interested in with his new imprint.
Yeah, and he's pretty switched on. I mean, I forgot to say at the start of the podcast today that after I met him, he offered to buy me lunch. So we went out in London, he took me to a nice restaurant, we had a nice lunch for a couple of hours, may have involved some alcohol, and because he's interested in Facebook ads and he's interested in mailing lists, so he's very switched on. He knows, he can see what people like me and you know, other indies are doing, and he's savvy enough to know, more than savvy enough to know, that there are some lessons that they can take away from that. We can teach them. He's obviously taught us lots of things in this episode, but he knows that indies tend to be pushing the boundaries quite a lot, and we can teach them plenty of things that will enable them to sell more books too.
Yeah, and on the if you think about potentially developing other revenue streams for yourself, I'm not talking about you. I'm talking about potentially people listening to the podcast who've perhaps taken your course, who are good at the Facebook advertising, really got it sorted, seen their own income grow, there's got to be the potential there for smaller imprints or smaller publishers using the services of somebody who's cracked it, who knows, who can come in, maybe it's once or twice a week, and run campaigns for division. I know it's not something you've got time for.
I've been asked loads of times. I did it last year for my agents asked me to come in and help them set up their imprint. So I did come in for about 3 months, I think, every week. And they paid me a lot of money to do it as well, which was very flattering. But there's only so much time that I can spend on things. It isn't really for me, but there's definitely a space there for an indie writer who would like to spread out a bit, have different income streams to offer themselves as a consultant. There's a lot of opportunity for that right now.
Yeah, definitely. Have a think about that. So when you crack Facebook ads, it's not necessarily just for you. You could leverage that skill set that you've developed for other people. Okay, before we go, we've got a webinar coming up, haven't we? Do you want to talk about that?
We do. So David Simon Garland, who was on the podcast way back within the first 10 episodes, I think, he is probably the best, I'd say, the authority on building online courses. He's the guy that we went to when we were building the first Facebook Ads for Authors course. We followed his structure. It works. I mean, Nick Stevenson also is an alumni of David. And he is going to do a webinar for us on Wednesday the 8th. We'll put details in the show notes where you can sign up to that. I'm just looking over at Mr. Dyer behind the camera to remember to stick that up there for us. And what we're going to go into is David's tips on how to build a course. And it's going to be perfect for nonfiction writers, especially those who can see that the book need only be the first part of the business. In fact, you could do much better from positioning yourself as someone providing an online course, a big booming area. Obviously, as we know, we're in that fairly firmly with our courses. Also, though, it could also be of use to fiction writers. It's possible. I mean, I'm a fiction writer, and I've obviously branched out into doing courses. Fiction writers, you could do a course on writing fiction, for example. You could, all kinds of things, research you could look at. There's loads of things. Using Scrivener, there's another writer that we know, Matt Morris, has done a course on using Scrivener. So there's lots of potential there. David is really switched on. He says boom a lot, and he's very American, which is great.
Yeah. So there'll be quite excitable.
He's very excitable. He's an excitable little puppy. He's a good guy, and I think it'll be well worth coming on board. So I don't remember the time off the top of my head, but we'll put that in the show notes over at episode number 50.
Yeah, okay. So that's the webinar. Get the details at selfpublishingformula.com for this episode 50. And you mentioned Matt Morris. I'm currently liaising with Matt. Matt is an expert on Scrivener. Scrivener is such an important tool for many of us writing. And yeah, I think most of us know that we scratch the surface with the software. Matt did a fantastic set of sessions for our 101 course on using the formatting, compiling aspect of Scrivener. But what I want to get Matt to do is to come in and do a webinar for everybody, a free webinar, and just give us a masterclass on using Scrivener. Off the back of that, some of you may be interested in his course, so we'll make it worth his while. He can talk about his course a bit, but really it's just sitting down for an hour and listening to somebody who understands Scrivener to take us through, you know, maybe the top five things that we're not doing in Scrivener that we could be doing to make our writing easier. So I haven't got a date for that yet. I'm in negotiations with Matt over it, but that will certainly be available to everybody listening to the podcast when that comes along, probably in March. Okay, great. Date of the webinar again?
Wednesday the 8th of February.
Okay. Look, thank you very much indeed for joining us. Episode 50, our half century. Is 50 significant in American sport? 50 home runs in a season. That's Sammy Sosa and Matt Maguire and those people. That was about 50. That was about 60, wasn't it? 62, 63 they did. I don't know what the record is now in baseball. It's probably 70 in a
goodness knows. I know Super Bowl 51 this year.
Super Bowl 51. Okay, so they're one ahead of us.
They're one ahead. We'll catch them on next week.
And it's only the 45th president.
They'll be the 46th next week.
Yeah, who knows? Fast-moving world of politics. Thank you for listening. Thank you for watching. Do leave a review on iTunes if you can. We'd love that. And we will see you for episode 51 next week.
You've been listening to the Self-Publishing Formula podcast. Visit us at selfpublishingformula.com for more information, show notes, and links on today's topics. You can also sign up for our free video series on using Facebook ads to grow your mailing list. If you've enjoyed the show, please consider leaving us a review on iTunes. We'll see you next time.